out of Oklahoma City, you're listening to the Good Trash Genre Cast, where movies are more than just 90 minutes in a bucket of popcorn. The Good Trash Genre Cast is a member of the Good Trash Media family. For more information, go to goodtrashmedia.com. They're talking about you,
boy, but you're still the same. Hello, everybody, and welcome again to the Good Trash Genre Cast, where a bunch of people gather around a table, and we discuss the films that you will never discuss in the course of a film studies class. This week's film is a host pick from our illustrious co-host, Dalton Stewart. What are we watching, Dalton?
Dustin, we are watching the 2000 classic starring John Cusack. It's Stephen Frears, High Fidelity. One of my all-time favorite films.
But yes, indeed, we're going to be looking at the film High Fidelity, which is a documentary about dubbing with a reel-to-reel tape, or perhaps something else. We will discuss that here in a moment, but first we must introduce the disembodied voices speaking to you all through your MP3 playing device. To my right, sir, who are you?
Hi, my name's Caleb Masters, and Dustin, I was the one who wanted to date the musician.
Accurate. All right. Thank you very much for that. Across the table, ma'am, who are you?
My name's Alexandra Bohannon, and if you really wanted to screw me up, you should have gotten to me earlier.
Excellent, excellent. And to my left, sir, who are you again?
My name is Dalton Stewart, and Dustin, do I listen to pop music because I'm miserable, or am I miserable because I listen to pop music?
I think you're just miserable.
Probably.
Probably accurate.
Need more sex.
Accurate statement. All right, my name is Dustin Sells, and I never thought I'd hear myself say this, but can I go to work now and maybe do a podcast? So
are you ready to do a grown-up job, Dustin?
A grown-up job? No. Are you kidding me? Absolutely not. Now, we need to warn you, dear listener, this is the first time you've tuned into the Good Trash Genre Cast. You might not know exactly what you're in for. You might have come from one of our other spinoff shows on the Good Trash Media Network, and so the particulars of this show are this. We take a film, ordinarily a film that's not going to be part of a film studies syllabus, but then we go into that film and we try to avoid some spoilers in the first part of the show. By doing this, we give a synopsis and then our quick thumbs up, thumbs down reviews, which tend to be spoiler-free. Then we move into our game, which can be spoiler-full about the film in question, or spoiler-full about other films. In this case, it might be something other than films that we might spoil if you haven't heard it before, maybe, but we'll talk more about that later. And then finally, once we get into our analysis, that is the spoiler zone. So that way you know kind of what's going on, and you have now been warned.
Dustin, let me ask you a query. What do you think? You're the only one here that's like a legitimate film scholar. What do you think the odds of High Fidelity being in a film studies course are?
Odds are slim.
I kind of thought so too.
Yeah.
You the only reason I ask is you mentioned that usually we do films that aren't going to come up in film studies, but when we do host picks and certain marathons, we break those rules. And I was just curious what you thought. I don't think so either. I don't think it really warrants that discussion. I mean, it's very much a middle brow kind of crowd movie.
Well,
it's not like important in the history of film.
There are a couple factors to consider when you're going to ask the question whether a film's going to end up on a syllabus. One of those things is there a body of scholarship dealing with it already? High Fidelity is going to be, there's going to be an essay or two out there, I'm sure.
I love that you keep insisting on calling it High Fidelity.
Hi-fi.
I understand why you're saying it. It's just stupid. But anyway.
Okay, again.
Yeah, I don't think there is a lot of scholarship about this movie.
I'm actually speaking in tongues today. I speak stupid today. And
get the fuck out of here.
That's what's going on. But no, I don't think it's going to have that body of work, nor is it a sort of milestone marker of a transition in film or sort of a major work by a particular director.
I mean, yeah, the only thing I can see it coming up is like a course in like late 90s, early 2000s. But I mean, that's very specific if you're just talking about American filmmaking.
I mean, you could do a particular kind of star study, I think, with John and Joan Cusack. And I think
I think it would fit into something kind of talking about the malaise of the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, basically mid-90s and onward pre-9/11 films. I think it might fit in, you know, with the conversation about, like, with Office Space and American Beauty films, like, of that era.
I think there's that. And there's also, I think, a connection that could be made, which began with Martin Scorsese and earlier even with Kenneth Anger, this use of popular music as a sort of a major vehicle for how you drive a film along. This film is definitely within that, you know, ethos. And so it could have something to do with that. But, yeah, for the most part, not going to be a thing that's going to happen. But, so, anyway, that's why this film belongs belongs on the Good Trash Genre Cast. Thanks for that, Dalton. We don't usually have that conversation, and that's
I thought it was worth talking about.
And so let's go ahead and move on in our liturgy. And as you would turn now with me to In Your Hymnals, let's hear the synopsis of the film High Fidelity.
Rob, a record store owner and compulsive list maker, recounts his top five breakups, including the one in progress.
That's the movie.
That's the movie, yeah.
I don't think this is exactly what you would call a plot-driven film, guys, so there's not much to it.
Yeah. Is it?
No,
really?
Definitely
no
not.
Plot, yeah. Not a plot-driven film? No. I couldn't tell. Huh. That's so weird.
Huh. Well, Alex, you had such a reaction just now. Let's hear your thumbs-up, thumbs-down review of High Fidelity.
Well, I really enjoyed the film. I have to say, as someone who, I was not like a teenager in the 2000s. I was, you know, a young, not adult. I was an adolescent, I suppose. And so I wouldn't have been able to appreciate this piece of cinema in the theater or in home media. But as a young adult myself who has gone through many breakups, I can safely say that this is this rings home. It rings true to me. Some of the love scene things, I could have done a little more record store, less love subplot, but that's just one of those things of like it's an integral part of the movie, and it's kind of hard to be like, well, you know, less love and more record store. I feel kind of weird saying that, but it did kind of play kind of long about the love stuff, but overall I thought it was awesome. Like it really speaks to me now as someone that's kind of getting into vinyl now, like as a mid-20s person. I like how it kind of reflects where I am at this point in my life, minus like the breakup stuff.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for that, Miss Alexandra Bohannon. And Mr. Caleb Masters, what do you say in terms of your thumbs up, thumbs down review?
I liked it quite a bit for the reasons Alex mentioned. Because I think it's really mature in how it looks at breakups and turns despite it being a movie that's all from John Cusack's perspective, I think it does a really good job at turning the attention inward versus outward. What am I doing wrong? Where am I failing? Where am I screwing up? Versus, what are they doing? Which is something we see in so many different rom-coms out there. And I think it's really nice. It's reflective. It's smart. I really enjoyed a lot of the performances. John Cusack is John Cusack is John Cusack. Therefore, he's great. This is some earlier Jack Black, too.
This is one of his, it's not his first, film was The Jackal, starring Bruce Willis. That's a fun.
Really?
That's a fun.
This is like right.
First, big roles. Yeah.
He's
so good in this movie.
Yeah. So, okay. Tenacious D, after?
This would have been after. I think they were already performing at, clubs and stuff. But, yeah, this is before their HBO show.
Yeah, this is before the HBO show, but after the formation of the band.
Yeah. Thank you. I was pretty sure they were already, doing their sets of comedy clubs.
Late 90s. I'm pretty sure they started playing. Yeah,
that's amazing.
Because Kyle Glass is in the film very briefly, right?
Oh,
I thought I saw him.
I might have missed him.
I could have sworn I saw him. It's been full disclosure. I'll let you finish what you're saying, Caleb.
Yeah, no, but I think the movie is really great. I really appreciate the way it uses music as a tool in which to trigger us as viewers in a way I think it's really, really effective, more effective than I think most films do, especially those of us who are, millennials or Generation Xers, who a lot of these songs are going to resonate to specific experiences we had. So I think that's a really great thing it's got going for it. Overall, I was really, Dalton, you picked, I dare challenge you when you call it a classic. I don't know if I would go that far, but I will say that I really liked the movie a lot, and this is a great pick.
Thank you.
Excellent. Well, thank you for that, Mr. Caleb Masters. Dalton, defend why this film is a classic with your review. Go.
I think it is a great piece of American cinema. It is one of my very favorite films. I think it is understated and nuanced and interesting and really beautiful. And Caleb hit on one of my favorite things about the film is it is a really mature look at relationships. My relationship with this movie is long and sordid. I discovered this movie on basic cable. It was a heavy rotation on VH1 and Bravo of all networks, between 2002 and 2005 probably. So I've seen this movie, literally dozens of times in bits and pieces. It's a film that I adore. I love this movie. I don't know. I've never been into vinyl. I'm still not. I didn't even really get into music till I was 17, 18. So I would have been around 12, 13, 14, 15 when I discovered this film. And it just spoke to me on a really deep level for whatever reason. I was something of a late bloomer, so I could relate to feeling rejected and out of sorts and introverted and uncomfortable with my emotions. And so it was always a film that I really connected with on an emotional level. And the more I watch it as I've gotten older, the more I just think it's one of the most mature films about relationships that studio has ever produced. I really feel that way. I think it's an adult film in that it's for grownups. It is a grown-up movie about grown-up feelings, although that's not to say that a teenager can't appreciate it, because I really did. It's a film that, again, really spoke to me in a big way and had a lot to do with my interest in film.
Excellent. I also liked the movie quite a bit. I was entertained. I laughed out loud. It passed the 6 laugh test.
Okay, I was about to ask about your laugh total.
It's a very funny movie. Yeah, I totally skated past that. It's really funny.
It's all Jack Black. I mean, you know, Cusack's funny too.
You said Zach.
Did I say Zach?
You did say Zach.
I meant Jack.
Yeah.
Jack Black.
How great is that that fucking cameo from The Boss?
Oh, man, I love me some Springsteen. So, yeah,
it's so good.
I was all over that. So, yeah, and he's playing this little blues riff. It's just hilarious that's going on there. I'm with Alex, though. The love story, I cared less about. You know, again, this is a movie that
Monsters.
I care more about the style than I do the substance.
Right.
Almost.
Interesting. Okay.
And so it ran a little long in that sense. I remember at the point at which he got the phone call about a serious event in the life of his ex-girlfriend. I was like, man, would they just hurry up and get back together or not get back together and just end this? You know, because I mean, that's sort of rom-com plot. And we do know enough, and it's the 2000s. You know, the romantic comedy does not necessarily have to end in them getting together or not getting together. But I didn't really care which happened. I just wanted it to be resolved.
Exactly. Right?
And that's, we both, Alex, you were kind of talking about that off air, and I don't. It's so, or no, Dustin, you and I were, and it's hard for me to divorce myself enough from this film because of my relationship to it to understand that feeling that you both are having. I'm kind of out of sorts with that, and I don't know, Caleb, do you agree with him? Were you invested in the relationship between Rob and Laura?
More so than Alex and Dustin were. I will admit, though, the film did run a little long, I think it's more like I appreciate the idea of what I think the romance story is about than I do the actual execution, because my favorite scenes are all in the music record store, all of them. But I really like the themes and the ideas that we're wrestling with in the romantic story, if that makes sense. But okay, it could have been about like
that's
15, 20 minutes shorter, I think.
Yeah, okay. I guess I'll agree to the extent that I do think the subplot with Tim Robbins runs a little long, but it gives us some really funny scenes.
Well, you know, and I do love seeing Tim Robbins.
Tim Robbins is a fucking old hippie.
What's great about this movie is sort of its use of those actors who were having their heyday in the late 90s, early 2000s, or beginning careers like Catherine Zeta-Jones or Tim Robbins, or seeing a Cosby kid all grown up and looking
fine. Lisa Bonet is gorgeous.
Yeah.
Tim Robbins is starting his career in the late 90s. Lumping them in with the people who were having a heyday.
People who were also having, either starting their heyday.
Gotcha.
Catherine Zeta-Jones, you know, sort of beginning at that point.
Fair enough.
And the launch is forward. Tim Robbins has definitely been working for a minute, though. And it was interesting seeing those characters and those actors doing that sort of thing. And, you know, despite sort of some mushy plotting or editing that goes on there towards the end, Jack Black doing Marvin Gaye forgives all sins.
That's so good.
So that's all I have to say about that. So there you go, dear listener. Our biases are generally pro, and we tend to like this movie quite a bit. But enough of this foolishness. Guys, it's time to play the game.
It's time to play the game. Time to play the game.
This week's game, our top 5 breakup songs.
That's right, top 5 breakup songs, brought to you by High Fidelity. High Fidelity, available now.
Ew.
I didn't mean to do a DJ voice.
Yeah,
but
you were like a shock jock DJ.
I did on
an
accident, but it felt right.
No, totally, actually.
Coming at you now, Alexander Bohannon's top 5 breakup tracks.
Yeah, that's right. Because we don't have the formula.
Guys, this song is really fun. This voice is really fun.
Oh, that's true.
Sorry. Uh-oh.
We don't have the formula because it's usually two dudes. One's really crass, one's kind of normal, and then there's a lady that's like, now, boys, you need to calm yourselves down.
Oh, I forgot that you just discovered that Marin bit. It's so good.
Yeah,
right?
It's a good bit. But yeah, top five breakup songs inspired by some of my real life and some of just like, you know, if I were breaking up today, this is what I would listen to. So for some classic 1980s feel, we're going to go with The Cars' Since You're Gone, because nights are getting strange since you're gone. Nothing's making sense since you're gone. I threw it all away since you're gone, you know, etc. And which is actually now an album I now own on vinyl. Another hit from the pre-aughts is The End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine
oh,
by
yes.
R.E.M.
Oh, I love that song. That's fantastic.
I actually was watching a one-off episode of RuPaul's Drag Race that is about the apocalypse. I'm not going to go into RuPaul's Drag Race, but they did talk about, you know, this R.E.M. song. I'm like, that's actually a really great breakup song. So I'm just going to include that in my list.
It's on my playlist at least once a week. I don't know about with breakups, though. But...
Yeah. Well, yeah, that should be accurate. And one song that has gotten me through a breakup before is the Taylor Swift hit, Bad Blood.
I love you.
I know. It's fine. It's just the music video is really great. They're fighting each other on top of buildings and they're like wearing corsets and shit. It's really badass. Another one for that, you know, empowerment after the breakup, whenever you're feeling really low, why not turn on some drag queen top 40 and hear RuPaul's Glamazon just to reclaim your female empowerment as you're trying to get over this breakup. And
I do that all the time.
Absolutely.
I love that.
You should. And last but not least, one of my favorite songs by a sadly not as well-known artist as he should be. The title speaks for itself. The song title by Stephen Paul Tyler is called Shit's Fucked.
Accurate.
Thanks. Well, all right.
That's so good.
Wow. Well done. Wow. Okay. Well, you have some work to do, Mr. Dalton Stewart. Go.
Okay. These all are based on my real life. None of these are in theory. These are all very real. I thought about this for a while. So I'm going to start out with my two cheats. I cheated twice. Because I couldn't pick one song off of either of these albums.
Oh, I thought you were doing something autobiographical about your breakups.
No.
I thought that's what you were referencing.
I cheated
right
twice.
Oh, shit.
That's what I thought you were doing.
I thought you were a good human being, man. Come on.
Okay, first of all, just because somebody cheats doesn't mean they're a bad person.
It's true.
Second of all, I have always been a faithful lover. Unless you count all that porn.
No one counts all that porn.
Nobody counts that stuff.
So, we are going to start off. Just made Dustin blush, and I love it. We are going to start off with the Modest Mouse record, The Lonesome Crowded West, which is one of my all-time favorite records, but is just so fucking good. And if I had to pick one song, it would probably be Cowboy Dan. But really, that whole record is one of my all-time, like, Somebody Died, Breakup. I mean, that is my go-to, like, melancholy album. I love it, but it definitely got me through at least one breakup. Next, another record got me through a breakup. It is got a little bit of a Modest Mouse connection. It is the indie rock supergroup Mr. Heavenly and their as of now only record, the eponymous Mr. Heavenly. It's so good. So good. Lots of songs about love, lots of songs about being angry, lots of songs. Just a beautiful song or a beautiful record. If I had to pick a single song, I don't think I could. I might go with... Wiseman is a really great track, and so is Bronx Sniper. Those are both really great tracks off of that record, and I love it to pieces. Next, we're done cheating. These are the top three breakup songs. I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself by the White Stripes, which is such a good breakup song. That is literally about, I don't know what to do because you're not here anymore, and I'm so used to doing everything with you, And that is a feeling I can relate to, because the hardest part of going through a breakup is not knowing who you're going to go to the movies with anymore. As a movie person here on this podcast, it's the worst.
White Stripes is really good at breakup music.
Yeah, they're really good.
Yeah,
the White Stripes is great for everything.
You don't know what love is, you just do what you're told. That's another really good one.
That one was in strong contention.
Yeah, same.
Next is, I think, just... a fabulous song, but really one of my favorite breakup songs. It is "Into My Arms" by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. Thank you, Dustin.
I knew you'd
like that one. I'm gonna do like Alex, and give you just a little nugget of the lyrics on this one because I think it's great. I don't believe in an interventionist God, but I know, darling, that you do. But if I did, I would kneel down and ask him not to intervene when it came to you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's some good shit. Yeah, it's a good love song, too, but it's also really good to wallow in love songs when you're breaking up. Last and certainly not least, my all-time number one breakup song, Waylon Jennings, Can't You See? Gonna find a mountain, the highest mountain, gonna jump off and ain't nobody gonna know. Can't you see what this woman has done to me? Yeah. It's a fucking all-time country song, and it is the best breakup song, hands down, bar none.
And naturally, it's a country song.
Yeah. Well, yeah. A real country song.
Yeah.
You fuck yourself, Brad Paisley.
Oh. Well, Paisley might have mentioned later, but nonetheless.
sorry.
That's okay. I like
him. He's throwing shade.
But anyway, Mr. Caleb Masters, what are your selections?
Yeah, so I've just quick honorable mention because I want to confess that I really like Coldplay.
Continue, because I think I know what your pick
is. It's an honorable mention. Well, no, it's two albums because like the White Stripes, Coldplay doesn't know how to write one album dedicated to a breakup. We've got two. So firstly, we've got to go with the classic, the one that came out when I was in high school or middle school in there somewhere. I listened to it at the time was Parachutes, which is the one that has all the popular songs everyone knows from Coldplay. But most recently, Ghost Stories album, which is a nice mellow album. Like, you know, Coldplay's known for. I like Coldplay. That's an honorable mention, though. I want to get on to it. So I'm going to start with one that is hip and is new, because I think if you haven't listened to it yet, you need to do yourself a service and go listen to it. And that is going to be from Beyonce's entire album of Lemonade, call out to Hold Up, which is the one where she is, like, just digging her claws into not Jay-Z at all. Anyway, it's a great album. Beyonce is phenomenal. Personal ones. All these tie into actual breakup stories. So, somebody I used to know by Gautier. That's a classic, another really big popular one. Here's one that I was actually just talking before I came over here about songs and in which you always listen to when you're about to kill yourself, apparently. And so I've got to go with Radiohead, True Love Waits, which is another devastating, like you're like on the edge. You're on the edge when you're listening to this song, but it's so good. It's so good. It's painful. Drabs. I had to go back to a high school story. I've got the Maps by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs.
Oh my god.
Ooh,
that was so close to being on my list.
I love that song.
That is one of the most beautiful fucking songs
really
ever
is.
Written by human beings.
It is, and it's so simple, and anytime I hear it, like even though it's about a breakup, like I just feel at peace about life. Anytime I'm in a bar, I'm like, yes. And lastly, I want to give a shout out to Noah and the Whale, which is a slightly lesser known band, but I really like them a lot. Blue Skies. And that one's also one you listen to when you're really down, but it's a little more optimistic. It's kind of, you gotta move on without that love. It's really hard, but guess what? The sky's still blue, and you keep on moving on. It's really beautiful. If you're in like the absolute pit, it's a great one to kind of start the upswing.
Thank you so much for that, Caleb. You know what, Caleb, you were so generous and so open and honest. I'm going to throw out one that I left off because I was embarrassed. It's Puddle of Mud's She Hate Me, which yeah. I left off because I was embarrassed. Yeah,
no
high school Dalton. Really, really Aww. Enjoyed that a lot.
I mean, high school is an important time in everyone's life to some
she
degree.
She fucking
right?
hates me.
I probably listened to, okay, if we're going shame songs
now. Yeah, give us a shame song.
Hey, hey, you, I don't like your girlfriend. You say no way, think you need a new one. Hey, hey, you, I want to be your girlfriend.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I love you.
So that classic by Avril Lavigne.
Oh, all right, Pops. Let's get some Cure in here.
So what are you going to put on this? Are we going to put some Bee Gees?
Some Echo and the Bunnymen?
There is going to be no Cure on this because I don't break up like you people do. Okay.
Oh, wait,
okay.
So, wait. Really? So the Cure is going to be on your list?
No, it's not going to be on my list. You know why? Because
you
when I break
up,
I go to anger really fast. See,
I die in a fire, and move on.
I
thought Alex had one of those. I thought about putting one. And those aren't the ones that really got me through it. But that's why I went with Mr. Heavenly, because it's got some ragey songs. And ditto for the Lonesome Crowded West. It's got some, like, it's mournful anger, I guess. But I get what you're saying. So give me that hate.
No, yeah, the hate and the funny and just, you know, let's move on and keep on keeping on. Okay, starting off with Brad Paisley's I'm Gonna Miss Her. She's gonna dump me because I'm going to go fishing. So if I go to that lake one more time, she's not gonna be there when I come home. The chorus hits up. I'm gonna miss her.
Yeah.
That's fine. Whatever. Do your thing.
I know you like going fishing.
I do like to fish. And that would be a deal breaker for me. Anyway, how about Cake? I Will Survive.
Ooh, oh, okay. God. Cake's great. That's great.
Take my hand. That was a close pick for me.
Okay. Yeah.
That Cake's cover of I Will Survive is so good.
It's a good song anyway. How about These Boots Were Made for Walking?
Yeah,
forget you. I'm moving on. And then, you know, the number four, Hit the Road, Jack, and Don't You Come Back. All right, let's get on
get some
and
oldies
keep
on
keeping on.
I knew he was going to be old.
But
sorry, continue.
Well, I'm going to get a little, I'm not going to get that much newer, but I'm going to get a little newer for number five. And I always wanted, I love there's a moment where this song is used in a Julia Roberts movie. And it's, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. It's in Runaway Bride. And like, yep. Time to move on. I just got to keep hunting. And let's just keep on keeping on, keep moving forward, you know.
You would have a U2 song.
Well, I would have a U2 song, absolutely.
U2 deserves to be listened to by everyone. Another band everyone hates on for some reason. Anyway,
because they downloaded an album unrequested on everyone's iPhone.
That's why they're beautiful. They gave us the gift of life.
And fuck you, Bono.
I listened to it 25 times.
Listen, Raised by Wolves is one of the greatest tracks ever. Okay?
Thank you.
And
I agree.
And continuing in this thread of, like, I don't care, I'm time to move on, and having a guilt track, I'm going to just throw in a guilt track also. Mambo number five. That's right.
That's
Move
a great
on.
Song.
Let's go. Okay.
Okay. I didn't go this route. I also boot up a lot of songs about fucking a lot of women when I'm getting broken up with.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. So I went with the sad ones because those are the ones that I really default to, but usually after the third day, it's all songs about my prowess with my penis. Thanks, hip hop.
My Prowess with My Penis by DJ Dalton J. Stewart.
Yeah.
Well, guys,
I'm hoping Dr. Girlfriend never leaves me, but if she does wise up and realize she's too good for me, Run the Jewels has two perfectly good records for getting through that, and they're working on Run the Jewels 3, so.
Well, guys, if that wasn't gameplay, I don't know what was, and I know you want to participate in this conversation via those magical means
give,
that we know
give
as
give us them top five breakup tracks, guys.
Yeah, we want to know. We want to hear it. Do it via social media. Alex, where are some of those social media means by which the conversation could be held?
Sure thing, Dustin. You can find us at facebook.com/goodtrashmedia. You can also find us on Instagram at goodtrashmedia. You can also find us at our parent website at goodtrashmedia.com. And you also can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/GTM.
Thank you very much for that, Dalton. There remains yet one other means. Tell us about it.
Yes, if you would like to hang out with the snobby intellectual elitists who shit on everybody that knows less than them, you can reach us on Twitter at good_trash. That is for all of Good Trash Media's content, not just this show, but also Back to the Movies, The People's History of Film, The Cast Who Knew Too Much, and The Film Syllabus, all of our content, and a host of other programs that we do intermittently. All of that is good_trash on Twitter. So please go there. It's a great way to interact with us if you are so inclined.
And for the record, dear listener, that line was from the film I Actually Love You All.
I do too.
I can't. Well, okay. I was going to say, I can't speak for Dalton, but I think so.
I love most of you.
Well, some of you.
Most.
Okay.
I'd say most.
Fair enough.
Everybody love everybody.
I don't know. It's the internet.
You're such a fucking pacifist. Finally, if you could please go to iTunes, rate and review this show and any other Good Trash Media content you're into. We would really appreciate it. It means the world to us. In the interest of Caleb's spirit of goodwill and love, iTunes is a great place to do that. If you really are into this show and you want to help spread the word, rating, reviewing, and subscribing over at iTunes is a great way to do that.
That's right. So thank you very much for all of that, and thank you in advance, dear listener, for all of your feedback regarding this show and the other great shows from the Good Trash Media Network. But enough of this, guys. It is time to get down to business. That's right, dear listener, and that business in question is, as always, analysis. I am very stoked to hear the words that these humans are going to say around this table. I'm going to begin with you, picker of the film. What do you have to say about High Fidelity, Mr. Dalton Stewart?
So one of the things that I really appreciate about High Fidelity is how it flips the script on you about 20, 30 minutes into the film. When the movie starts, everything, it's all poor Rob. Isn't Rob so sad? And I think anybody who has any self-awareness probably picks up on this pretty early. Rob is kind of an asshole. Honestly, that's before we find out the circumstances about his and Laura's breakup. She revealed not two, but all four pieces of information to Joan Cusack. He borrowed $4,000 from her. He slept with someone else while she was pregnant, which led to her terminating the pregnancy. And he said that he was kind of sort of maybe thinking about seeing other people. Before you learn that, though, even in that first scene, Rob is an asshole. Alex, you're shaking your head. I'm assuming yeah. I kind of was wondering what you would think about. I was worried the first scene would turn you off from the movie because it doesn't make it clear what the movie thinks about Rob in that first scene.
I completely felt like the movie thought Rob was an asshole.
Okay.
I thought he was kind of an asshole after the first scene, too.
I think what works really well about this film is even if you don't pick up on that, I think the film does a really good job of making you realize in hindsight that he's been an asshole the whole time. I think the moment where that really crystallizes is when he goes back out with his high school crush that's now a film critic of all wonderful things and says, so why did you leave me and then go have sex with that other guy? And she's like, you broke up with me, you fucking asshole, because I wouldn't have sex with you, and it wasn't rape, but it wasn't far off because I was too tired to say no.
What happened with the next guy, yeah.
Yeah, and it's this really heartbreaking and beautiful scene that Rob learns nothing from, because as soon as she gets up, he goes, oh my God, she's right, I did break up with her. This is great! I'm learning so much, and it's an amazing scene, but it really, I think in that moment, really crystallizes what Rob's problem is, and I think what this film says so beautifully, and what I think a lot of people's problem is they make themselves the hero of their own story, and when you do that, when every story in your life is your story, you're always the hero, and when you're always the hero, you can do no wrong, and when you can do no wrong, you will learn nothing. And this whole film revolves around Rob learning to be about something other than himself. To learn the way he acts affects other people. And to learn that not everything is what he thinks it is. We were talking about this a little bit earlier in review, but a big problem with his relationship with Laura is this idea he has of her, this idea of comfort, this idea of contentment that he has about her. That, well, everything's fine because it's just nice. Well, that doesn't mean everything's fine. You still have to work at it, even if it is comfortable. And he learns that with Charlie, where he was like, oh, Charlie was so cool. She was too cool for me. And then he meets Charlie and realizes she's an asshole. Charlie's terrible. She's pretentious and obnoxious to be around and always has something to say. I have known so many people in my life like that, and they're unbearable to be around. But there's something about them when you're 19 years old that draw you in, and you can't help but want to be around people like that. I think it's really interesting for Rob to realize the people in his life are more than what he thinks they are to him, and that's part of his journey. And I think that's really one of the things that I love so much about this film, is it really is a very empathetic film, and not just in that it makes you relate to these characters, but it makes you want to relate to the people in your life, because it's a film that encourages empathy. It's a film that encourages not only self-reflection, but also hopefully a self-reflection that ends in looking back outwards at the people around you and realizing they're going through the same things that you are going through. It's not just about you, you fucking asshole. The world is bigger than you. And I think that's my favorite thing about this movie. And I kind of love the melancholy of the ending. Because the film does not hint that Rob and Laura are going to break up again. What it does hint is they are going to continue to have problems. They're going to continue to have issues. And he's going to continue to be tempted to move on to the next thing. He's always going to be looking because it's hard not to sometimes. But I think what the film does is does have this beautiful melancholy of saying, Rob is still kind of an asshole, but he's learned something. And I think a lot of films struggle in doing that. I think a lot of films do one or the other. The first film that comes to mind is Young Adult, the Jason Reitman film, which is a film I really like, but goes the hard other way, where Catherine Zeta-Jones, Charlize Theron, I know what her name is, I just was thinking about Catherine Zeta, where Charlize Theron's character learns nothing, literally absolutely nothing. And then you have a film, other films like It's a Wonderful Life is the first thing that came to mind, where the character learns every single lesson they could have possibly learned and everything's better. And I think it's easy to go one way or the other. And what Stephen Frears does in High Fidelity is have Rob kind of land in the middle where he has learned something, but he's still Rob. He's still going to have the same problems. And again, I just think that's part of what's so beautiful and so special about this movie is the way that it does encourage empathy in the viewer, and that it does lend to it, because there are plenty of films about white guys in their 30s in love and white guys in their 30s breaking up. What I think this film does that's so special is broaden that microscope out just a little bit, encourage reflection and encourage people to consider how their actions impact other people, and that people have their own internal lives that operate outside of their own.
Excellent. Thank you for that, Mr. Dalton Stewart. Mr. Caleb Masters, what analysis do you bring?
Yeah, well, just like I mentioned in my review, I think one of my favorite things the movie does is it utilizes music. And I think the movie is just as much about memories as it is about music. And then the songs that, the way memories are triggered by the songs and our experiences with them. The whole film, Rob is sorting through his past and his past relationships by thinking through his failures. And he somehow makes a playlist for almost every breakup, or at least the film does for us, and plays it in those parts. And I think it's the movie is very specific in those choices of music in each scene as they relate to Rob's former relationships. Now, each former relationship is meant to associate very specific feelings with each breakup, at least for us, for him, and for us, the audience, specifically. And so what Stephen Frears is doing here is he's using our relationship as the viewers, relationships with these songs to summon the nostalgia so that each of us kind of take our own trips down the emotional memory lane. And I think this movie does really, really well, actually, because even though all of us have our own experiences with all of these songs, they're in the film. What you're gonna see is though we are all part of groups. We were in high school at a certain time, and we heard that song as a flashback to the 80s or the 90s. We all have very specific instances with all these songs on a macro level as well as a micro level. So what I think what Frears is doing is really, really great. And I know, Dustin, you talked a little bit about how, you know, you've got Scorsese using music to a similar effect, but I think there's a distinction here, because this film I think is specifically mining nostalgia in a way that's different. Scorsese is trying to summon a specific like emotion. Well, I think this is actually specifically trying to have elicit memories for us, the viewers, and have us thinking, oh yeah, what was that like? Oh, and that probably reminds me of some time I broke up with this person for something. So I think that's a really, really cool, just kind of formless tactic he uses. And the way he uses the music in the film is really exceptional. And I think more so than almost any other film I've seen, it really captures the idea of harnessing nostalgia and the power of memories. Now, I know we're a movie podcast, so of course we've spent lots of time talking about the power of film and how films summon specific feelings, our entire lifetimes, and they take us back to those moments. And we were on episode, 202, I think? So, you know, there are dozens of podcasts you can hear us talking about, oh yeah, I watched this movie so-and-so, and it brings back these feelings. But I think that the media of music is actually even more effective at doing that, because even something as short as a simple line to a certain melody can take us right back to, in this case, the worst breakups we've ever had in our lives. So I think this movie, and especially since we're in a right now we're kind of in the era of where nostalgia is everything. Everything's nostalgia all the time. Every brand's nostalgia. What I think High Fidelity does is it artfully harnesses nostalgia using songs, knowing its generation, knowing its target demographic, which in this case is going to be mostly Generation Xers when it comes out. But I think it works just as well for a lot of us millennials who heard a lot of these songs later when we hit our teenhood. So I don't know. I don't have a lot else to add to it, but I just was really impressed with the way that Stephen Frears is able to use music as a tool in which to elicit those really deep emotions that we all kind of carry around with us.
Thank you for that, Caleb. I think that's a really good point about the film, especially those conversations. I mean, I think the conversations in the record store about music really help highlight that. Dustin, I cannot wait to hear what you have to say about the film.
Okay, so I want to talk about two things, two sort of separate things. I'm going to talk about them both very, very briefly. One, very, very critical in terms of
classic Dalton Stewart analysis.
Wait, did you say one critical?
Critical theory.
I thought we were going to talk about the critic girlfriend. Okay,
no, yeah, right, and yeah. And then I'm going to talk about criticism.
I like
there we go. So, okay, that's what I'm talking about, Dustin.
Yeah. We're going to get there, and so that might be more of a discussion.
Caleb, your puns are cute.
What's that?
I said Caleb's puns are cute.
Yeah, it's fun. So here we go with the critical theory piece. Walter Benjamin in the age of the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction talked about the sense of aura, about the work of art as an original, about having it and holding it and possessing it. And as mechanical reproduction happens, it gets more and more distance, and you want something more and more like the authentic artifact. And so this is fundamentally what's at work in the entire sort of phenomenon of record collecting and the sort of vinyl revolution. It is about somehow getting back to the physical media.
You're closer to the art.
And getting closer to the aura of the art. But Benjamin also says the closer you get and the further you get, no matter what you do, you always experience this great sense of distance, that you never can quite close that gap between yourself and the aura itself. And that it's always sort of an uncrossable gulf that you experience with the work of art. Now, I want to tie this into the romance story about John Cusack's search for love and this sort of perfect woman, perfect sort of image of a woman, especially with his relationship with Charlie's character, played by Catherine Zeta-Jones. Because she becomes, in Lacanian sense, the petite object awe, right? Or what Louis Buñuel would sort of play off the same sort of idea when he titled one of his films, That Obscure Object of Desire, that you desire the object, but the closer you get to the object, the further it goes. It dissolves like sand in between your fingers, no matter how much you want it. Once you actually achieve the thing, you realize it was the wanting that you wanted, not so much the having that you wanted.
Or as Gillian Flynn, is that her name? The lady that wrote Gone Girl?
Yeah.
Yeah, as Gillian Flynn, so succinctly put it, the cool girl.
Well, okay, something like that. Well, I was thinking in terms of panties, because the film actually has a dialogue.
Such a gross word.
With this about panties?
Panties is a gross word.
Panties? Why do you have your panties in a bunch about panties?
Alex is with me on this one.
It just is a weird word.
It's a weird word.
Is it just like weird out of my mouth because like, I never
said panties? No, it's just a gross word.
Okay.
This is a whole thing. It's like you know how some people can't stand the word moist? There's a whole group of people that are like that with panties.
Oh, okay. Well, I apologize. Trigger warning for more panty talk coming on here.
It is kind of sexy when you say it.
Panty warning?
Panty pool.
Here's the thing, though. He talks about this idea that he wants to live this life where he's surrounded by, you know, sexy, lacy panties. And what he ends up finding when he ends up living with a woman is that they have a few pairs of sexy panties, but they also have the cotton granny panties.
They only wear the sexy underwear when they know they're going to have
sex.
When
they're going to get laid, yeah. I mean, that's when the time is right, that's what you do. And sort of that realization that as soon as he gets close to the object, he realizes the object is not quite the way he objectified the object, the woman in question, in this case. And this film does something really interesting.
Quote, cool girls are, in fact, real human beings. They are not just there for you to think they're cool.
And the film is then about the pursuit of woman as object. And there is an extent to which John Cusack's character, in sort of typical bourgeois values, is able to come to a point where he's like, okay, fine, you know, it's about love and it's about caring, and I want to do this thing with Laura, but I still have my brain thinking about these other possible things. And the thing is, though, is that objectification of women, that objectification of women is also a way of constructing an aura about them, that by by auralizing them, you have by nature objectified them. And the closer you get to them, there's a distanciation from that very aura, and it begins to slip apart. And so this film has
aura.
He was trying really hard.
I did so good for so long.
You're such a child.
I oralize everybody.
and so I think this film has a really excellent way of doing a dialogue between sort of a Lacanian psychoanalysis and Benjaminian critical theory. Mm-hmm. And so there's something going on there that I think is just fun and worthwhile. But the other thing I was thinking about was this idea of the making of lists as critics, as connoisseurs, as appreciators. That this is a thing that we do, and we construct these lists. The end of the year is coming up. Caleb, I know you're working very hard on your end of year list. I know Dalton and Arthur
write lists
also.
Like,
and
weekly,
so is Alex.
Yes.
Yeah, we all are.
Weekly.
I have at this point seen 52 2016 releases. That is a new release a week.
That's not quite as good as mine, Dalton.
Did you? Oh, I'm so proud of you. No, I'm happy. I know you and I both like were fucking putting
it's close.
Putting leather to cobblestone.
All right, shut up, both of you. I have to watch a whole bunch of movies because at this point I've seen 12 2016 movies.
That's
and
a really...
Kung Fu Panda 3 is going to make the top 5.
All right. You got time. There's still time, Dustin.
I got some movies to
you
watch.
You got to catch up with Green Room, brother.
I know. There's some things I got to get done. But here's the thing, though. We construct these lists, and there's a sense in which this list making is part of doing that whole canon thing. Right. This
oh, yeah,
is the stuff
time.
You've got to see. This is the stuff. And there's a weird way in which sort of identity politics of the person making the list also sort of informs the way that list is constructed. And there needs to be more awareness that say, hey, this is who my people are. I know who I am. But I need to be thinking more about finding those things that are from people who are not like me so that I recommend those things. A, but also B, I think there's a real public service. Mark Cousins, and I could not find the article about a year and a half ago in Sight and Sound. I went digging through my boxes. I recently had a move, and I have like a big box of Sight and Sound issues. But Mark Cousins talked about how film criticism needs to be a lot more like, this is where the high fidelity idea comes back in, more like DJ work. Where what we're doing is we're putting together playlists, where we're helping spin records and helping people know this is the thing for the thing that you're looking to, and this is how you can discover some new things via the thing that you already like.
Absolutely.
Well, I think this film, making lists is something that's really resonated really well on the internet recently, because I think that's what people are looking for. I write lists for Screen Rant every single week, and let me tell you, people click that shit like it's no one's business. Like people love
lists.
They're very easy to digest, and I think it's a great way, Dustin, to your point, like how that is, most people would prefer to read that than like a really in-depth review or analysis.
And I think that's part of why we close each episode every week with an Elsewhere Instead pairing with the film, because I think, and I know you think as well, Dustin, I know that's why we started with this format 4 years ago. I know it's weird to say. I think it's really important to try and curate. A friend of the show, Nick Sanford, and I, one of our favorite things to do after we watch a movie together is program a fictional triple feature to sandwich around the movie we just watched. And I think that's really important to continue. I think Cousin said it best. Film critics should be like DJs. Yeah. Absolutely.
And so, like he spins out songs for spinning out film. And I think that's an important part of the discussion. So, without any further ado, let's do that. Let's make the mixtape with High Fidelity. And so, I want to hear your recommendation about this film as we render this verdict, shelf or trash. And then I want to hear your else's or instead's. I go to you first, Mr. Caleb Masters. Shelf or trash, else or instead.
Yeah, I'll shelf it. I really liked it. I'd gladly watch it again. I think there's a lot of value here. And even though I don't think it's flawless, I definitely think there's a lot to revisit. I think again, the soundtrack is lots of fun. If you guys look at the full soundtrack list, it's great. It's great. Look it up. If you're listening, look it up online. And there's just classic after classic in there. To watch alongside it, if you're going to watch not a funny version about movie about breakups, you go watch Blue Valentine. But that movie, the thing I like about that movie is that movie also is the person doing the breaking up is looking inward versus outward. Which I think is a really important thing. Although, if you're going to watch that movie, prepare to bat down the hatches, because that one's heavy. Another really cute movie about playlists, or a list that I enjoy, Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist.
It's a very cute movie.
It's a very sweet little movie. I've only seen it one time, but I really liked it a lot. It really resonated at the time. This one's tricky. I have really mixed feelings about this movie, but I do think it kind of fits the same vein and same style of film we have right here, which would be 500 Days of Summer. Although I do have some problems with the way it portrays, you know, summer in the film. I think it's a really interesting way to look at the breakup process and the stages of grief and things like that. Things that I'm not sure that our character in this film, Rob, is dealing with until years later.
Excellent. Thank you for that, Mr. Caleb Masters. Ms. Alexander Bohannon, shove her trash elsewhere instead.
Yeah, I'd say put it on my shelf. I really like it. I think this film is integral as someone like myself going through late mid-20-somethings hood. Tender moment between the two of you right
over
there.
Over a lighter. Yeah.
As John Cusack so smartly says during one of the flashback sequences, it takes a very special mindset to think you're going to be alone for your entire life when you're 26. That snapped into focus for me. I was like, motherfucker, I am 26 years old now. I've been watching this movie since I was like 13.
Yeah.
That was a very surreal moment for me.
Yeah, no, it's...
I don't think I'm going to be alone for the rest of my life. I'm
not currently,
and I keep planning on keeping it that way. But, it was... Man, that was surreal.
Yeah, it's always weird whenever you watch movies and you're like, oh, I'm now substantially older than the person I looked up to in this movie or piece of media.
Or I'm the same age
You know, and that felt so far away then. But for... if you want to have a trip down a couple memory lanes in two different ways, how about you relive high school through two movies I will recommend to you. That is 2007's Juno. I think that is a really natural pairing with this film. And then I'd also recommend a 2016 release, Edge of 17.
That was so good. I saw that you watched it.
Yes.
Did you dig it a lot?
It's great.
It's so fucking good.
That movie.
I saw that by myself on a Friday afternoon, and it was awesome.
We had a row of 17-year-olds behind us.
Oh my God, did they love it?
Yes, they did.
That's
yeah.
Good.
So, that movie is great, and it gives me hope that future people are not going to be all shitlords. So, continue.
Excellent. Thank you for that, Ms. Alexander Bohannon. Mr. Dalton Stewart, picker of the film, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
But let's hear your show.
I'm shelving it, but it's really. Does my heart good to see you guys shelf it, because it's been a while since I had a host pick that this many people liked. I would recommend you pair with this film one of Stephen Frears' more recent films, Philomena, which is another really interesting film about the way we form bonds between people. A really sweet movie that kind of came and went, and nobody really ever talks about it anymore. It made some year-end lists when it came out. It kind of came and went, and I think it's a really sweet film. I haven't revisited it since it was, in its first release.
Judy
Dench is really good in it. I think Steve Coogan's really good in it. I think it's really a sweet film. I want to recommend two fucking peak John Cusack movies to pair with this, and that is Gross Point Blank and Being John Malkovich, which are very different and yet very similar to this movie. Gross Point Blank has a lot of great music, is very funny and very interesting. Being John Malkovich is really interesting and nuanced in the way that it approaches how we relate to the people around us. You could not pick three more different films, and yet at the very same time, you could not pick three films that fit together more perfectly. And finally, my other favorite film about love, and that is Paul Thomas Anderson's Punch Drunk Love, which we have talked about on the show before. So if you want to hear our thoughts on that, you can go listen to our February anti-trash marathon from 2014, I want to say.
That sounds right.
Yeah. I have a love in my life, Dustin. It gives me a strength you can't possibly understand.
It makes no sense to me.
And that's what I say to everyone right before I fucking wail on him with a tire iron.
That's exactly how it went down. But moving on, there was a conversation off mic. I am actually going to diverge from the table. I like the movie a lot, but I don't think it's a shelfer for me.
And that's understandable.
But it's not, for me, it's not something I'd want to purchase.
Fair. Yeah,
that makes sense. But definitely it's a watcher. So it's a very, very soft trash. Insofar as it can be. What instead you should watch is a two avant-garde films that will take you less time to watch than half the runtime of this film.
Okay. Fuck you.
It
does run long.
It could be
a little tighter. It's under 2 hours.
It could be
by
as
4 minutes.
Easily and else as an instead is what I'm trying to say. First of all, starting with Joseph Cornell's Rose Hobart. It's a film made from the fragments of the print of a film called East of Borneo from the late 40s. What Cornell did is he cut the movie up into tiny pieces and reassembled it. He was very obsessed with the lead actress whose name was Rose Hobart. And he dyed the whole thing blue and then put all this sort of crazy music from the film Brazil on top of it. And it's got this very, very fun kind of calypso feel of stuff that was very, very popular in the late 40s, early 1950s. And it's sort of about his obsession with the actress Rose Hobart. And so
I could do a movie like that.
It's fun, yeah.
It would be about Rudy Mara.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah. And so that's a fun movie, and I think it's worth your time. It's on YouTube. You can find it quite easily there. Also, Kenneth Anger's Scorpio Rising. The reason why I select this is because it is a playlist of great 50s songs.
Into it.
She Wore Blue Velvet, My Boyfriend's Back. So many, many great songs played on top of gay men working on their motorcycles, gay men putting on their leather outfits to ride. Doing some sacrilege and desecration of a church, all of this sort of stuff with these great fun 50s pop songs. Okay, and I think it's a great.
I want to see this so badly.
I really want to see this, dude. Yeah. This is awesome.
Scorpio Rising is my jam, y'all. And so,
into this.
Yeah. You'll have to tell us off mic how they specifically desecrated.
Well, it was actually a massive influence on Martin Scorsese and his use of popular music in his films that happened later.
That kind of cognitive dissonance.
Yeah. And so, anyway, recommend it really, really highly. And it, as you, dear listener, are a shelfer or a trasher with regard to this film, these, I think, would be great Elses and or insteads for you there. This is how we are spinning the records for you all, dear listener, as we are selecting the films and helping you out to find new, amazing, and wonderful things, because that's what we do here at the Good Trash Genre Cast. So thanks for listening and tuning in to what we have to say about this next week.
We've had some recording difficulties of late. The holidays have made scheduling an issue, so we have had some bye weeks, and we do apologize for that. But because of that, we are going straight from one host pick to another. Mr. Caleb Masters is going to close out the final episode of the year proper. We are going to do a year-in-review episode in the coming weeks, but this is going to be our final film discussion of 2016. Caleb, what's your pick, buddy? No pressure.
Okay, well, you know what? Guys, we have to do a Christmas movie, right?
And God damn it.
No, we don't.
I don't even like Christmas, but come on. It's Christmas season. People were thinking about Christmas things.
Eyes Wide Shut.
Oh, that's a good Christmas movie.
Is that the Christmas movie?
Is it Eyes Wide Shut?
No. You motherfuckers already did me the disservice of doing Die Hard and Gremlins in the first season.
Yeah, we did the only two.
The greatest Christmas movie ever made.
That's why we don't do Christmas movies. We did the only two good ones.
You wrecked everything. So, okay, I'll put it this way. I thought about an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. I thought about it really hard, and I was like, you know what? That might be fun. But you know what? We've done an overwhelming amount of Arnold Schwarzenegger on the
We've
Good Trash Genre Cast.
Thanks for not doing that one.
Thank you for not making me watch Jingle All the Way.
I thought about doing a certain Tim Allen film, which I also love, that I watch new every year. But you know what? I don't think you guys could handle Tim Allen. I don't think it's in your souls to handle Tim Allen.
I don't have a soul. Gonna find a
mountain. The highest mountain owned.
I thought about talking about Macaulay Culkin.
I could live with that.
I thought about it real hard twice.
Oh, Skyfall. Okay, yeah.
We already did that movie.
Sam.
We did already do Skyfall.
But you know what? I realized there's probably not a whole lot there other than some really fun home invasion analysis. So that leaves me with one option. Okay. Because I just want to point this out, guys. I hate Christmas.
So what's the pick, man?
We're going to watch The Christmas Carol, but we're not going to watch just The Christmas Carol. We're going to watch The Muppet Christmas Carol, the best version of Christmas Carol that's ever created.
Yeah, all right. The mission statement of the show is to talk about the films you're never going to discuss in a film studies course.
Thank you very much for that selection, Mr. Caleb Masters. This will be fun. We so command it. So therefore, it shall be. But because it's really not about that. It's not about the actual content of the film, because movies are so much more than just 90 minutes in a bucket of popcorn, guys. It is about the conversation. It's about talking about what matters in life and how we understand ourselves as human beings. That's what makes watching the movie so worthwhile. So you guys, keep watching. We'll keep talking. Merry Christmas. We're going to watch A Christmas Carol. It's going to be fun, darn it.
The Good Trash Genre Cast is produced and edited by Arthur Gordon. Direction by Dustin Sells. Social media by Alexandra Bohannon, Caleb Masters, and Dalton Stewart. Our intro and outro is Night Call by Kavinsky and Lovebox. We are also proud to feature music from Deer Tick this week on the program. For more information on this episode of the Good Trash Genrecast, as well as the rest of the Good Trash Media family, please visit goodtrashmedia.com.